were saying when they passed it and what their intent was. And even though he talked like he was sympathetic to my point of view, he said that he told me it was unwinnable because contractors have money and are organized. So they just sort of sell that like an option, you know, and they sell it to somebody and it becomes a, like a tax credit in effect for some other entity, like in our case in the city, Mercy Housing.
So wait a minute, I'm a little bit confused. The measure says they're supposed to build low-income housing for every X units. They're supposed to build
a
Y number of low-income. And
right. A percentage of housing, when it's going to be more than your individual personal home, has to be affordable to low-income and working people. That's the essence of it. Now,
how often has that
what
been
that
done?
Means to me is, you know, every sixth house should be something that me or you or a 20-year-old who's working could afford. But what it means to the developers is, who can we dump this obligation on? So they don't even try to do it. Mm-hmm. And so they in effect, give a kind of artificial money or credit to whoever they can get to take it off their hands, and then they proceed to build as a for-profit investment.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even, nobody attempts it.
And that's been these kind of sort of scandal-ridden, dense housing projects like Neary Lagoon, Mercy Housing.
Well,
what's your opinion?
I don't want to respond to the scandal-ridden part of your sentence.
Let me ask you this. What the money, instead of there actually being buildings, instead of constructing low-income housing, they've given it to some other agency to construct. Is that the what?
Yeah, in effect. I mean,
and what has been the result of that?
Well, you could say that there had been a greater chance of success when an agency like Mercy Housing attempts to package together enough funders to pay for a low-income housing project, or are more likely to be built, and a, quote, affordable, end quote, housing project.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of like Granite or whoever would have built the richer place is an invisible partner to something else, and it represents local money, which a percentage of these things have to be. So there's some merit to it. I just still personally think it's a sellout, it's a cop-out, and it gives the municipalities or the county a way out of having to have any kind of coherent plan for that part of the population.
But wait a minute, isn't Mercy Housing doing all it can and isn't doing a fine job, and isn't that a step forward and so forth and so on?
I have a not on either side of the politically correct track opinion about Mercy Housing. I don't know if you want to air it on your show.
Well, are they the main person that's been, main organization that's been building these things, or?
I suppose you could say that. If you're saying low-income housing, absolutely yes. If you're saying affordable housing, maybe.
So
the Housing Authority themselves, which is a countywide weird board that gets federal money, also builds, but not so much in the city of Santa Cruz, more so in the unincorporated county.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, has there been much housing built as a function of these requirements in ONJ? How much housing has been built?
Well, I don't think you can measure it out, or we'd need a very sophisticated accountant to do that. But by waiting and clustering it together, the people that cop out of building it when they build their profit housing, they're preventing these communities from having all levels of housing in all the neighborhoods. So there's some quality of life issues that I see when you cop out this way.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, in fact, make what Mercy Housing tries to do, which is to put housing together that's decent and clean and viable and affordable for people like me or Laura, who's also supposed to be one of the people in the upcoming Homeless Issues Task Force.
You're both on that task force.
Single mothers could afford it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, so how many units of affordable housing for single mothers has Mercy Housing created?
Well, single mothers, in my experience, can't afford what's called affordable housing. It would have to be low-income housing.
Low-income housing.
I don't know how many. I know where most of the projects are, and I could sort of go out and count units.
Well, I expect you to come back with specifics for my next show.
I'll do that. Maybe not for your next show, but give me a week.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I'll find out what they take credit for. But meanwhile, you need to understand that they're kind of like brokers or jockeys, and it's somebody else's money that builds or refurbishes these places that then become affordable or low income. So we need, and I especially think the organized people in the beach class, I wish they could hear this, we need to see them as a horse that needs someone to take the reins of. I think the community needs to be much more forward in saying what they do want and not just what they don't want, because I think Mercy Housing's structure is being underutilized. They are good at getting these funds and stringing them all together somehow, but there are cities where...
So you're a supporter of Mercy Housing, then?
They've experienced me as a critic.
I'll have to lock you and Phil Bear in the same room together and see who comes out alive.
No. I'm claustrophobic.
Mm-hmm.
But
what about Habitat for Humanity? How do they stack up with this?
Well, I read in the Sentinel, so consider the source here, that Habitat for Humanity never wanted to deal with the city or the county again, that they had entirely too many penalties and fees and fines and zoning regulations and problems. But I see, nonetheless, that they're building here again.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it depends on their internal resources. I had a bad experience with Habitat for Humanity. I don't think it represents that they're biased in some way, but just too bureaucratic or something. In my experience, I was in a shelter in Watsonville, even though I'm a resident of the city of Santa Cruz by choice and preference.
You're one of the home residents by choice, eh?
Well, even when I'm homeless, if I have any choice whatsoever, I'm in the city of Santa Cruz. I identify this as my home, and it's the birth home of my children.
Mm-hmm.
Well, two of my children. And this is where I pick to live, you know, and I do without things in order to be allowed to live here, where if I were in Watsonville, maybe I'd have a yard or a private driveway, you know. I'm lucky to have any kind of shelter, any roof at all, because I'm in this city and have no money.
Mm-hmm.
Lucky and extremely patient.
Well, anything you want to add to this, Linda? Like, when is the next meeting of the task force on homeless issues?
I like that new acronym. I'm going to run with that one, Robert. I don't know when we're going to meet, but I'm going to have a tea party for appointees and other interested people very soon if we don't have a formal meeting.
Well, I know you have a majority of people now appointed, including Sherry Connival and Paul Brindell and Lou Rice and Laura Tucker, and I think that there were two others appointed at the last city council meeting. So that should give you the necessary critical mass to begin blathering away for 6 months.
Thank you, Robert.
Mm-hmm.
When I heard you talking to Fred, what I liked is that you suggested that if money is dedicated to the work of this task force, that maybe the task force or the public or the homeless people here have some say about how it's spent. I hope you will pursue that with the city manager, because I don't think task force members by themselves could necessarily accomplish that.
Well, you know, I suspect that people like yourself who are on the task force would be more likely to have impact than renegades like myself if the city manager wouldn't be caught dead in the same room with, but who
knows? I remember him pushing us all out on the brick walkway before because we outnumbered him and he didn't want to talk to us.
That was back in 1992, as I remember, yeah.
Wow.
We were trying to get then Council Member Kennedy to get out of the city manager's office. They planned to open up a parking garage for women to park their vehicles and sleep in, and we're still, of course, in exactly the same place we were before. Admittedly, with a lesser fine, and now you can park your vehicle in a driveway for 3 days out of the month. Thank you very much.
Well, that is a baby step forward.
Baby step?
I think so.
Well, for those who only sleep 3 days, 3 days a month, I suppose it's a baby step. Yeah.
If you know about 40 people with driveways they're not using, maybe you'll
It's a baby step for baby aliens, maybe. I don't know.
I found it harassment because there were so many qualifications. Like, you're allowed to sleep in your car, but even though you're not driving it, you had to have everything clean with DMV, up-to-date registration and title. The second time I was homeless here, I was sleeping in someone else's car. I was very grateful they loaned it to me and that it was long because they dumped it.
Right.
So I think those kind of, peripheral requirements create more hurdles rather than the opportunity they intended.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. when they made that change. And then churches have their own fears on top of that.
Oh, yeah, you're talking about, actually, that's the requirement since 95. It's been okay to sleep 3 to a church parking lot with the written permission of the church.
And all your DMV papers in order.
And exactly, all your DMV papers in order. And we actually talked to one of our disabled homeless activists last week,
Eleanor,
about the issue, and she talked about, you know, how it can work at times, but other times it doesn't work so well.
And she was also saying that police bother her anyway.
Yeah, the police are bothering
them
anyway.
Papers from the church.
And the sheriffs, even though the sheriffs have no business bothering anybody on this issue, since it is there's nothing illegal about sleeping in a church parking lot. No matter how many people you are, no matter with or without written permission, if you're outside the city, because it's not county property, and therefore it's not under their camping ordinance, which unfortunately does extend to roadways. You can only sleep on the roadway if you are doing emergency roadside resting, passing through as a motorist rather than a homeless resident.
And you have to convince the officer who pulls you over that you're tired and that you're en route.
Right. It's true. So, anything else, Linda, you want to announce that's upcoming, you think people should know about in terms of any... I know you're on the Women's Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women.
No, our commission is also impacted by the August vacation schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And so our subcommittees continue to work. I did want to say that $10,000 in this scheme of things you're talking about is peanuts. And I'd like to see something worthwhile done.
Yeah, you're talking about
not much money.
You're talking about the $10,000 to staff to help this homeless issues task force.
Right.
Which, again, what that really means is that the same people, and I don't think they're bad people, but I don't think they're also terribly good at it either.
Well, the important thing is who they are.
Arnie, and what's his name? Eugene Arner, who was on the commission for the task force for camping ban study, will be paid, you know, lots of, you know, their usual hefty middle class, upper middle class salary, whereas what they could do is they could spend that money for homeless people who might actually get, you know, not only provide information, but get some actual direct use out of the money, and I don't see that that's happening, unless, of course, all of you band together and insist on it, which might be good.
I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm open to that kind of banding together, by
mm-hmm.
the way. But,
great.
Isn't Gene already working and paid for all his hours for the city?
Well, I think he is a city employee. I saw him at the last city council meeting. I don't quite know what his job is.
I mean, I know a little bit about budget juggling, but it does seem like, from the little information I've been giving, that $10,000 is open, unless something was said this week.
Well, that would be good. Maybe you should call up Buckshot Byers, as I'm now calling her, with her... or sleeping band buyers, and see what our mayor has to say about it.
I like to deal with the mayor in person if I have that option.
Mm-hmm.
And I will talk to her about that.
I'll have her invite you to one of her soirees. thank you for calling, Linda.
I have one other thing. I think that where the police have been in their temporary old shelter would make a wonderful shelter for families that need to be in downtown, even if it could only accommodate 3 or 4 or 6 families. I don't see it being used for anything else urgent or as urgent. So I just wanted to throw that out.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we have, interestingly enough, one of your co-task force members has just entered the studio. Perhaps she can join
in. Is this legal? Are we allowed to talk to each other?
This is the FCC.
All right. I'm sorry. I only talk to the FBI.
Oh.
Learn my lesson.
I'll put in my application.
Yeah, this is actually, we have on the line with us Laura Tucker. She's actually in the studio with us. Laura, you're a formerly homeless mom, and you're also a member of the task force to obfuscate and to blather about the homeless issues.
Oh,
right?
From blather to obfuscate and blather. Boy, we'll have to hire you to be our PR agent with that $10,000.
Well, I don't want to seem too critical here. Go. You want to add anything, Laura? Have you been
listening? I just found out from Sherry last night that...
That's Sherry Connable, another member of the Issues Task Force.
That they have hired a staff member.
Mm-hmm.
And did she know who?
Gagged me with a spoon. And who was that?
Don Lane.
Oh.
No way.
No.
How could he be... No, we need someone that's literate and can make reports fast and keep up with our meetings.
I have to pick myself up off the floor here.
Yeah.
I think you should immediately fire Don Lane by a majority vote. Immediately. Not
the very first meeting, please.
First item on the agenda, new staffers. I mean, Lane apparently couldn't get a job kicking out Hispanic people from the Dolphin Lee Project, so now he's joining up with this task force to fuck around for a year. I mean, I'm sorry, this task force has got to do something about this, or I'm not going to talk to anybody again. I'm going to retire from my room in the next 6 months.
I don't believe you would give up that easily.
Yeah, pretty bad.
I need you to talk to Don Lane.
What does Sherry Connable have to say about this?
I don't know how much of what she has to say is confidential.
Oh, dear.
You know,
it doesn't sound good, folks.
She doesn't feel real positive about it, you know. And for myself, I don't know enough of Santa Cruz's history or Don Lane's history.
Let me give you a little background in Don Lane's history.
Good.
Don Lane was one of the council members elected in the 1988 council elections, where there actually was a lot of input from homeless people. Jane Immler was actually a homeless woman who was running for city council. There was Abdul Hassan was another pro-homeless candidate. And there were many protests every night at city council. I was being arrested repeatedly, as were many other people, demanding some changes in the sleeping ban ordinance. And Lane was making various promises, which he didn't keep. He did attempt to keep one promise by bringing up the issue in the first meeting in January of 1989, when he was completely ignored by Marty Wormhout, John Laird, Mike Rodkin, and all the other gang. Actually, Rodkin, I think, left the council at that point for a brief hiatus in academia. He had nothing to say about the sleeping ban for the rest of his term, pretty much. He spent his time attacking homeless activists.
Attacking?
Yeah, he attacked.
Physically?
No, he didn't attack activists physically. Lane was verbal.
While Lane
was mayor, people put in jail. Lane covered for Karen Gillette, who was a formerly Homeless Services Center director, who was actually notorious for kicking people out of her free meal program after having stolen the free meal program from Jane Immler because the city wanted a more pliable person to run it. She then was notoriously hostile to activists, and Lane was a very, very close friend of hers. And the most notorious incident was when she dumped a burned out porta potty on my front lawn, claiming that I had done it. I was actually in jail at the time.
You were in jail.
She was covered with threatening graffiti, and she actually left a nasty message in my machine. This is a woman paid, I don't know what, $30,000 or $40,000 by the county. You know, I mean, it was obviously an ill-judged move by her, but the significant thing was, when this was brought to Don Lane's attention, and he was mayor at that time, he refused to discuss it, he refused to consider it, he rejected it out of hand as, you know, in terms of any kind of responsibility for him, for his employee, Karen Gillette. And also, when Karen Gillette witnessed the assault by one of her co-workers of Linda Edwards, another activist, who was circulating a petition looking for better food at the Homeless Services Center, Lane gave no support whatsoever to any inquiries into this situation. And Lane is he's essentially, most recently, part of the established power structure. He wouldn't even support ending the sleeping ban last year. Mm-hmm. How could you have such a man as staffer on this homeless issues task force? He's obviously somebody who has stuck his thumb in the pie and pulled out a plum, and he's going to suck it all the way home.
So the city doesn't have any kind of open personnel procedures?
Well, that was something that, you know, apparently this is all legal, but I was a little disappointed because I had my eye on that staff position and really didn't even want to apply for the task force. I wanted to apply for the job of staff. Now, maybe I'm not qualified. I don't know the ins and outs of government as well as Don Lane, certainly. But there was, you know, no open hiring process, although I guess that's not the procedure.
I was under
the impression that they were going to use city staff and that we were going to get together and meet and that the task force ultimately would hire their own staff member. That was my impression.
Well, I think what you need to do is, I think you need to have an informal meeting and pass around a petition that each of the board members, that each member of the task force demands that the staff person hired be a certainly not an established... I mean, Lane was one of the politicians who supported the opposition in the last election. Not that this... Not that Fitzmaurice, Crone, and Sugar have done shit, mind you, but at least, you know, Crone and Sugar tried at various votes in the course of the sleeping ban discussion, made certain token statements that at least indicated that if there were a majority there, they would be voting for ending the sleeping ban.
That
Lane,
may or may not still be their position, I don't know.
But Lane, no, Lane supported Linda Steinau and the crew of people who was on the other side of the issue entirely. He did not come out against the Beach Flats plan, the Third Street realignment, the basic keynote issue of the last election. He had nothing to say about the Hispanics who were going to be evicted. He was standing right in line for a fat job with Mercy Housing to dump all the Hispanic people from Dolphin Lee. So I think this is outrageous. I would suggest you resign en masse from this group if he's the staff member.
That's thought.
I'd
like to say something on his behalf after listening to this particular litany.
Please.
I agree with some of the things you said, by the way, about his being not a friend of people that are poor or homeless. But Don was instrumental in getting the original use permit to establish Calamity's Cupboard, which was then pirated into being a free meal. It wouldn't have happened without his place in the city council at that time, because we weren't getting anywhere with Laura Brown city staff. That's just an example that I happen to be close to.
For a period of time, Lane was the most liberal person on city council, but the fact is, you know, he was liberal. It's like having Albert Speer on the Nazi regime. You know, thank you very much. I don't think you want to, you know, go hire Albert Speer on a human rights commission, even though he may have been more liberal than Goebbels. it doesn't really, you know, wash. I'm sorry, Laura, you were saying?
Yeah.
Well, my only experience with him was when we were meeting prior to the election with former city council member...
Are you talking about...
Anyway,
Kennedy?
Yeah, Scott Kennedy.
These were the behind the scenes Silva meetings where there was this attempt to do some kind of compromise on the sleeping ban. Kennedy, of course, with no apparent outcry from Lane whatsoever, sabotaged the entire process and delayed it for 3 or 4 months so that nothing happened. And eventually, there was no change in the sleeping ban of any significant sort.
Right. But so that was really my only experience of working with him, and at that time, it seemed like he was really pushing for it to be legal to sleep, at least in our meetings.
Not pushing enough to ever sign a petition to that effect or make a public statement. Thank you very much, Don Lane.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, I heard that he had made some positive statements about sleeping, you know. But making positive statements in a little committee session and going public, which everybody else was doing, if you can't go public... You can't decide on you know, to support Hispanic people who are being evicted. Then I think, you know, you should, you know, retire to the nearest, you know, to I don't know. I've always thought of Don as being a kind of a... Well, he and I have had our personal disputes. He's attacked me personally for my work as a homeless activist. He has a right to his opinion. I've attacked him for his bullshit as mayor, where he has done very little to support basic civil rights for homeless people. Particularly in homeless services, for example, where people like Karen Gillette, he'd made his private deals with them, and that was the all-important thing. But I think the problem here is he really is part of this cliquey in-group that is using... I almost look at it as a form of corruption. What is he doing getting into a situation where he knows a lot of people are not going to want him on that task force? And maybe Sherry Connable does, because Sherry doesn't, apparently. Well, they used to be pretty close, but I think Sherry sees the light on the horizon, or the, you know, she sees the, you know, the writing on the wall.
A lot more out there with homeless people now, and I think
she is
fully more informed her.
Yeah, I have a lot more respect for Sherry than I used to have, that's for sure.
I like to say something about Don. My concern, I'm not trying to add or take away from your summation of his mayorship, but my concern of putting him in a position where he's the production person and our link to the city, this task force is linked to the city, is that he quit as mayor. He quit. He said he couldn't take it anymore. We need somebody we can count on in that position.
I think also
very productive.
That as a staff member, you have a certain amount of power. And so it feels to me like the task force itself should have a little bit more choice in who they choose as a staff member.
Or any choice at all would be more.
Yeah, yeah.
I think what you need to do is sit down with a list of alternate people, and I think we also have to sit down with a essentially the kind of flyer that I wrote about Lisa Rose should be written about Don Lane in terms of a factual recitation of his history in this whole situation. And then the question is whether is he suitable, considering his history, considering, as you're saying.
You know, I'm a little hesitant, though, in I feel like this is the only bone that they have thrown us. You know,
Don Lane is our only bone. We don't need it then.
Well, not Don Lane, but the task force itself, you know.
Okay.
And a lot of people, including ourselves, are already feeling very pessimistic about it. You know, there's not a lot of excitement or positive, you know, oh, this is a great thing that's going to happen, you know. But I think that since it's the only thing we have to work with right now, well, certainly not the only thing, but officially...
Forget it. You want to use the task force. You don't want to let the task force use you. And you can't. I think you have to. If you can find a way to use the task force to take over abandoned buildings, to advocate in high-profile ways for homeless people getting beaten up by troll busters or harassed by the police, that you want to use it.
Yeah.
You don't want to sit around and say, "Oh, well, we kind of keep the task force. That's the most important thing."
No. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that I'm just hoping that we can kind of get off on the right foot. You know, instead of.
Maybe if Don Lane sees that everyone on this task force is serious and change-oriented, he'll just step aside. Laura had this great idea. I mean, we were just talking personally and in fun, but it's still a great idea that all of the task force members go out and live homelessly. Now,
if I did that, it could kill me,
but I mean, as an idea, a concept... And
actually, I was serious about it. I wasn't going to talk about it. I'd kind of asked you not to. But
I'm sorry, I fumbled, but I'd like to finish my sentence. My point is, if the staff person has some real experience, Robert was saying earlier, hire someone who's homeless.
Well, for sure. You know, I really think that if there's a job opening and, you know, we're a homeless issues task force, if there's someone that's homeless and qualified, then that's who should get the job. That's how I feel. And as far as the us becoming homeless, I feel real serious about that. I feel like, and I did want to keep it quiet only because I wanted to present it to the task force in a way that they might accept. But I do think that it's very important, not so that they can feel how horrible it is or shamed because they live in a house, but because they need to have the information of what's needed, be close to the people so they can talk to them, if you have the experience of being homeless even for a couple of days, then you have more information as to how people are being treated and what's needed, what's not needed, what's bogus, what's not, you know.
You know what I'd like to do, though, is I'd like to kind of open up the phone line in the thought that perhaps somebody else might want to be calling in, although I really appreciate your input, Linda, and I encourage you to call back shortly after giving it a little hiatus here.
Yeah.
I also, you know, I think what you need to know is who made this appointment.
And what,
I mean, who's,
what process?
Who appointed this staff member? I there are reasons why
I think
we lost Linda there.
There are reasons why I essentially didn't want to apply for this homeless issues task force, wanted to have nothing to do with it, thought it was bullshit, and continue to think that. At the same time, of course, when the issue comes up, I think it's important to comment on it, and we don't have an alternate process going on, which we should really be creating. When you have so many good appointments for the task force that you do have, provided they don't get seduced by the idea of the task force and away from what their fundamental activism should be, then I think that's great. We're in the studio with Laura Tucker, who's one of the Homeless Issues Task Force members. And I'm your host, Bathrobe Spear Robert Norris. This is the last half hour, so to speak, of Bathrobe Spear's Broadsides at 96.3 FM. Let's hear a little music and please give us a call. Our phone lines are open, 427-3772, 427-3772.
Yourself down and meet the best innkeeper in town. As for the rest, all of them crooks, rooking the guests and cooking the books. Seldom do you see honest men like me, of gentle good intent, who's content to be master of the house, doling out the charm, ready with a handshake and an open palm. Turns a saucy tail, makes a little stir, customers appreciate a bon vivant. Glad to do a friend a favor, doesn't cost me to be nice, but nothing gets you nothing, everything has got a little price. Master of the house, keeper of the zoo, ready to relieve him of a soup or two. Watering the wine, making up the wheat, picking up the knickknacks when they can't see straight. Everybody loves the landlord, everybody's bosom friend. I do whatever pleases Jesus, won't I bleed him in the end?
Master of the house, quick to catch your eye, never wants a passerby to pass him by. Servant to the poor, butler to the great, comfort to the philosopher and lifelong mate. Everybody's boon companion, everybody's chaperone.
The doctor feels the least to keep, wanna skin you to the bone. Enter, monsieur, lay down your load, unlace your boots, rest from the road. This way's a ton, travel's a curse, but here we strive to lighten your purse. Here the goose is cooked, here the fat is fried, and nothing's overlooked till I'm satisfied. Food beyond compare, food beyond belief, mix it in a mixer and pretend it's not. Kidney of a horse, liver of a cat, filling up the sausages with this and that. Residents are more than welcome, bridal suite is occupied, reasonable charges plus some little extras on the side. Charge for the lights, extra for the mice, 2% for looking in the mirror twice. Here a little slice, there a little cut, 3% for sleeping with the window shut. When it comes to fixing prices, there are lots of tricks he knows. How it all increases, all in bits and pieces. Jesus, it's amazing how it grows.
Master of the House from Les Miserables, one of my favorite musicals, and it's got some pertinent stuff. Well, before that last phone call and very interesting exchange between Linda LeMaster and Laura Tucker, with me butting in every few moments, I was about to read an article from the San Jose Mercury News, and I think I'll do that now. San Jose focuses on squatters. Police issue warnings, citations, make arrests. July 13th. In response to a growing number of complaints by property owners, the San Jose Police Department has begun a citywide program to oust squatters from business and residential buildings, drawing criticism from some shelter providers. They say the move is another attempt to move undesirables out of desirable areas at a time when shelter space is at a premium. Established more than a year ago as a pilot program for downtown San Jose, Stop Trespassing on Public-Private Property, STOP, was recently expanded citywide as one of the department's community policing measures. So far, police have made contact with more than 100 violators, according to Ruben Dallason, a police department spokesman. The first time, officers give out a warning and a card with phone numbers to community resource agencies. The second time can result in a citation or arrest. Here's a little aside. This is the kind of thing that Santa Cruz was doing in 1988, when it was recommended that they decriminalize sleeping in vehicles to some extent by at least warning people before ticketing them. Then Mayor Marty Wormhout voted along with Councilmember Mike Ratkin to issue little cards to people instead, telling people they could go to the River Street Mini Shelter. This was a shelter that currently still exists here in Santa Cruz. It now has, I believe, a total of 32 or 36 beds. Half of them are for homeless people. At that time, it had 14 beds. Two of them were for homeless people. So this little card, intended for 500 to 1,500 homeless people, maybe less than, maybe, I don't know, 300 to 1,000 then, this little card, speaking about services, was actually completely bogus, similar to the cards that were being passed out downtown as part of the Real Change, Not Spare Change, Panhandlers Get Out of Town program, which the Downtown Association in Santa Cruz was pushing a couple years back. So San Jose has got this same little racket going on, which is they are trying to persuade you that they're being very, very compassionate by giving out little cards saying these are the community resources while they drive away people from their sleeping places. We're getting complaints from business owners and residents in the downtown area whose vacant residence or business was damaged from vandalism, Dallason said. People were calling the police and flagging them down, saying there was something going on in this house. I'd like you to know that vandalism is a crime. So it's not like there isn't some existing law to deal with the situation. They're talking now about trespass. They're talking not about people who vandalize, because that's an appropriate basis for an arrest, but people who trespass in areas that, let's say, are abandoned or not used much, or that are near areas that are used. It's a form of discrimination against poor people, an attempt to gentrify an area, and again, a kind of a statement of priorities that we'd rather sterilize the area completely at night, turn it into the sort of a private dead preserve of the merchant community at night, so that they can maintain their businesses during the day, and just to hell with the needs of other people in the area, to hell with the needs of the poor people, to hell with the needs of the homeless. That's, in essence, what this philosophy says. And indeed, it's a very popular philosophy these days. Continuing this article, we said, let's get together and find out a way that we can reduce urban blight. Urban blight, of course, is a code name for homeless people. But Pastor Scott Wagers, a community minister of the First Christian Church of San Jose Disciples of Christ and director of San Jose's Community Homeless Alliance Ministry, said he believes the program's purpose is to remove homeless people from the city. It's part of a larger strategy to criminalize and marginalize poor people. It's just another way to target people who are victims, said Wagers, who estimates that about 4,500 people in San Jose are homeless on any given day. San Jose Councilwoman Cindy Chavez rejected that idea, saying the program is not a tool for the city to get rid of the homeless. Chavez, who represents the downtown district, believes police department program will enable officers to be more effective on their neighborhood beats. To participate, homeowners and business owners must fill out a form provided by the police department which authorizes an officer to enter private property in the event of criminal or suspicious activity. Now, of course, an officer always has the authority to enter on the basis of criminal activity, but suspicious activity is something else. Suspicious activity. Actually, a police officer also has the right to investigate suspicious activity. So one wonders what this is about. It's really kind of like a right-wing mobilization of the community to drive poor people away. Chavez also sees the program as a way to keep the community safe. Trespassers, quote, could be kids hanging out who are unsupervised, she said. It could be someone older who just shouldn't be there. I think it's an excellent program, especially when we're in the process of revitalizing, and frankly, I am excited. This is Councilwoman Cindy Chavez speaking. It's kind of interesting, this sort of absurd sort of statement reminds one of the excuses offered by the police department both in San Jose for its sit on the sidewalk, go to jail law, in San Jose and in Palo Alto a couple of years back, because they were concerned that people would trip and fall over homeless people, and they couldn't cite any specific instances where this had ever happened. Similarly, Amos Brown, running for re-election in the November elections up in San Francisco, has pushed a hold up a sign, go to jail law for people standing on the curbs, claiming that it's a public safety problem. Anything these people can do to cloak what they're doing in some sort of innocent format or seemingly publicly useful format is apparently what's being used. But it's so preposterous because they have no figures for this. And I don't see any figures in San Jose either, at least not in this story. Noelle Knell, Communications Director for the San Jose Downtown Association, which represents more than 2,000 businesses, said property owners obviously want to keep a clean appearance to the community and put their best foot forward. But Knell said the program's effect on the homeless also is a concern of the membership. She believes the community policing component is an essential part of the program. We want to do what we can to connect people to the abundance of services available, she said. We want to make sure that folks impacted by the program are aware of services that are available to them. The availability of services, however, is the problem, homeless advocates said. According to Wagers, the city has ordered his church's 50-person shelter to close by July 19th because of zoning restrictions. That's tomorrow. Wagers said the shelter will remain open even if the church had to shell out $2,500 in fines per day. We turn away people each night, Wager said. It seems that no one is really stepping up with a solution. It's a complex issue that can be worked with, but it requires patience and a degree of boldness. But things can happen. Homelessness won't go away. Jan Bernstein, Community Relations Manager for InVision, a nonprofit San Jose homeless program, said the problem may get worse before it gets better. With few affordable housing complexes, more families have been forced out into the streets. First, they stay with friends or family, she said. But when they exhaust their resources and supporters, they stay in a car, a basement, or an abandoned garage. It becomes a downward spiral. And of course, it gets even worse when these cops are running around driving everybody away from areas that aren't used at night anyway, except by people who have no other choice. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle, July 13th. So, and that brings us to our next interview. Assuming I can find it, that is, which is an interview with one of our, I would call him kind of an old friend in Buena Park, California. Assuming I can find the tape, of course. There it is. This is Wiley Drake, who has, well, let's let him speak for himself.
Right, it's July, no, it's Yes News, it's July 18th, and it's about 10:10 on the line with Ralph Drake of the, is it the First Baptist Church of Buena Park?
First Southern Baptist.
First Southern Baptist, sorry about it. I've never heard of a Northern Baptist church.
Well, I don't think there are Northern Baptists. There's American Baptist and General Baptist and Missionary Baptist and all kinds of Baptists, but one of those denominations, the largest denomination, the Southern Baptist.
Well, fair enough. now, Wiley, you are a person who's been in the news the last couple of years, quite strikingly, around the issue of shelter for homeless people. You want to kind of give us a brief sort of look back and then an update?
Yeah, well, I'd be glad to. Actually, what happened, just to give you a full-line scenario, about 8 years ago, we started a ministry to the poor and the homeless in the community in which we live, and we found ourselves very quickly, within about 6 months or a year, having not only a ministry to the poor, i.e. food and clothing to people that had homes, but we also began then to minister to a small handful of homeless people, five, six, seven, something like that, And then that grew very quickly into 30 to 40 people that were homeless, living in and around, behind stores, under the freeways, and so forth. And that continued on for really about 6 years, where we were continuing to minister to those that were homeless, give them a place to sleep, place to take a shower, transportation to and from work, help them find work, just help them in basic get their lives back on target. By getting them identification if they've lost it, going to court with them, just doing whatever is necessary to appeal to the powers that be, social services, the criminal justice system, other churches, anybody that could help these people get back on their feet. We operate on a tough love basis and did that for about 6 years with no fanfare, no accolades, nobody did anything that really, you know, bothered us or we bothered them. And in 1995, we had El Nino rains down here, and there were a group of apartments close to our church along the flood control channel, and those apartments indeed had to be evacuated due to flood threat. And they were evacuated, and the city called upon us to house these emergency homeless people. We did so. The city gave us an award for doing that, talking about what great people we were. And as they found out then, though, they began to realize that we had an ongoing ministry to homeless people that had other tragedies in their life. And they came to us and said, you got to quit doing that. And then ensued about a 2.5-year battle where they threatened to put me in jail for several years and several thousands of dollars in fines if I did not stop doing what I was doing.
Now, what you were doing was you were lodging homeless people in a church building, and you were also allowing them to sleep in their vehicles in the church parking lot, right?
Right, and of course, we stopped doing that because the city leaned on us and threatened to put us in jail and all that kind of stuff, and we brought them into the building, and then when we brought them into the building, they started getting picky. They brought the fire authority out, the health department out. They both gave us a clean bill of health, and then the city came in and said, well, wait a minute. You didn't dot these I's and cross these T's. You have changed the use of a recreational building from recreation to mercantile because we had like a thrift store set up. We didn't sell anything. We just gave it away. But we were still doing that, and so they found us, took us to court and found us guilty of four criminal misdemeanors.